one end of the metal is at room temperature, the other end of the metal is down inside the doer with the cryogenically cooled amplifier. And between the two, well, lots of heat is going to flow down that metal and boil off your liquid nitrogen and your liquid helium. So you're trying to make a piece of waveguide that is thermally insulated but highly conductive as far as radio signals are concerned. And that's an interesting compromise. You start off with a piece of plastic waveguide that has a silver plating coating on the inside of it, act like a waveguide with very little conducting characteristics. I know of other ways that they could be doing this, which someday I'm going to see if I can get anybody with some enthusiasm in that particular one. The more modern gas set transistors, and by the way, one of the questions that Howie asked that I didn't answer is, which devices give you the lowest noise figure? There is no simple answer to that. What frequency range? If I'm building an amplifier at 50 gigahertz, 10 transistors, indium phosphide 10 transistors, probably the state of the art. High electron mobility transistors made with indium phosphide at 50 gigahertz is the best thing you can do. Take that particular transistor down to 144 megacycles, and it's considerably worse than a bipolar transistor optimized for that frequency. So each frequency region has an ideal kind of transistor. You build very low noise oscillators at frequencies below 1,000 meg. You don't use FET transistors. You use bipolar transistors. And so, ain't clear. However, on many of these radio astronomy frequencies these days, the better devices are so good at room temperature, you might not have to cool them with liquid nitrogen. And some of the better devices of the field effect transistor style, whenever you lower the physical temperature of the package, you almost get half the amount of noise power output every time you half the degrees Kelvin of absolute temperature, physical temperature of the device. Bipolars don't do that. So cryogenically cooled bipolar transistors gives you a very small benefit. FET transistors gives you a large benefit. And then some other peculiar characteristics they discovered on, I think it was Mitsubishi transistors, super low noise FET transistors when they're cryogenically cooled, for some reason stop working unless there's a light-emitting diode with infrared energy alongside of it. And people make a joke the transistor doesn't like being in the dark. You have to give it a nightlight in order for the transistor to turn on and give you gain. I'm not sure there's a simple explanation of what's going on there. K2KEY, KQRIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Yeah, one final word. You know, the only thing I thought was this, I meant to ask you this question so many times, and every time I think of this thing, I always say I forget. This time I made it up. They were, at that time, I think it was around 1,400 megahertz something they were doing. Searching for, I think they were doing some of that SETI business at the time. You know, they were devoting a lot of time to that at one time, back in 85. Now, he was explaining to me, you know, I was asking about the Stevens and all, I said, what's this, or something like that, and he told me, he said, that the first, after the first mixer, the first IF amplifier was at 260 megahertz at the time, megahertz, that time was a little different, we talked different in those days. Okay, 260 megahertz, if I'm not mistaken. He said, then they go to the next IF, and they went to 30 megahertz. And I said, gee, that sounds awful low. He said, oh, we specifically have to do that to compensate for the Doppler shift caused by the Earth's rotation, which this, I don't even know. That I remember hearing, but I never understood that, Dick, over.
Okay, when you're doing 1420 meg, so-called 21 centimeter hydrogen line observation, if you have completely free hydrogen molecules floating around in space, in free space, if anything excites that molecule, like a star shining some light on it, and the electron gets excited to the next higher orbit of that hydrogen molecule, and when it feels like it, it relaxes and jumps back down, it emits an extremely specific wavelength, which everyone calls it 1420 megacycles. somewhere in one of my calculators here, I've got the exact frequency to about 9 decimal places. So there's an exact frequency you want to listen to. So with that receiver that goes from 1420 megs down to a first IF of 2260, and then to an IF of 30 megahertz, they're measuring an exact frequency in order to find out how fast is that cloud coming towards you or going away from you. In other words, since you know the exact frequency coming out of that hydrogen molecule floating in space, it's like a crystal oscillator traceable to the Bureau of Standards, a very exact frequency. You measure that frequency, and if it's a little bit higher, you know that the distance between you and that cloud is decreasing. If it's a little bit lower, you know the distance between you and that cloud is receding, increasing. Okay? So the cloud itself of electron, of polyhydrogen molecules you're looking at, which is probably part of some remnant left over of a supernova of that particular star, and you plot the velocity profiles of that nebula, and you know how different portions of the cloud are moving with what radial velocity from you, but in order to get the next level of accuracy, you have to take out Earth's rotation. Let's make it simple. Let's make the believe that the star you're looking at is at 0 degrees of declination. That means it's right over the equator. And if your particular radio telescope is also located right on the equator. And if at the time you're looking at the star, the radio telescope is aimed straight up in the air with zenith, that's where the star is. In that particular situation, Earth's rotation does nothing. Because of Earth's rotation, you're moving 1,900 miles an hour on the equator around the Earth. The Earth is 24,000 miles in diameter. You're covering 24,000 miles in 24 hours. You're moving around 1,000 miles an hour in circumferential velocity just by standing at the equator. As far as Doppler shift is concerned, you're part of that motion. Your radio telescope is moving. All right, if the star is straight up, you're moving at right angles to the angle you're looking at that star. No problem. That's pure cross-track velocity. However, if I'm looking at the star right at star rise, in other words, at one end of the... I'm looking at the Earth from the star's point of view. I'm looking back at the Earth, and now I'm way on the left-hand limb of the Earth, and the Earth turns counterclockwise top view. I am now racing toward that star at 1,000 miles an hour. My whole radio telescope is at star rise. You know, it's like sunrise, but at star rise. I'm racing towards the star. At star set, or sunset, so to speak, I'm on the right-hand side of the Earth, and I'm receding. I'm moving away from the star at 1,000 miles an hour because of Earth's rotation. All right, I've made it simple. I've only talked to you about the equatorial rotation velocity for a star that's directly at zenith above that equator. Life gets more complicated where you and I live. You and I live 40 degrees above the equator. The star is not directly overhead at some other angle. So there's three-dimensional geometry involved in the way the Earth's rotation and our velocity around the pole of this Earth, the way that velocity adds and subtracts to the measurement you're making. I wonder if that made some sense somehow. K2KEY, K2LIW.
I can visualize what you're talking about, Victor. This is K2KEY. Is there anything magical about being that it had to be a 30 megahertz IF? I mean, he specified, he says that the 30 megahertz IF was to compensate for Doppler shift. Is there anything magical about 30 megs, or is this something that was arbitrarily that they came up with, Dick, over?
Both Hewlett-Packard, Implant Instruments Laboratory, and other companies made a whole series of instrumentation that does exact frequency measurement at around 30 megs. There's nothing magic about 30. It could have been 21.4 megacycles, a megahertz, could have been 70 megahertz, could have been 455 kc, so to speak, as long as you don't run into image and real type problems. So the exact frequency where they choose is strictly a function of what instrumentation they've got and the accuracy of the oscillators that are doing the super heterodyning down to the lower frequencies. So when it comes to measuring exact frequencies, the velocity profiles of a cloud of material that's out in space, and each molecule, a hydroxyl molecule, a cyanide molecule, whatever, they all have exact frequencies they emit. So you beat everything down to 30 makes because that's where the instrumentation is. But when you're doing pure polarimetry radio astronomy, where you want to measure with radiometry techniques the maximum possible sensitivity, which is usually resolution of at least 1 Kelvin or 1/10 of a Kelvin, now you want not narrowband, you want broadband. There they use 500, 1,000, 2,000, sometimes 5,000 megahertz of receiver bandwidth at the detector. If you make the bandwidth in front of the detector very broad, like 1,000 megahertz, if you make the bandwidth of the video after detection very narrow, like 10 hertz or 1 hertz, or 0.1 hertz, you get a huge integration factor. With Dickey switching, which means the front end of a receiver is connected first to the antenna and then to a carefully temperature regulated dummy mode. You flip back and forth between the two, maybe 400 times per second with a square wave. That's called Dickey switching. It allows you to make extremely fine resolution temperature measurements with extremely high accuracy, way below the noise temperature of your receiver. I could be using a mixer front-end receiver that has a 10 decibel noise figure. I don't know the exact number. Maybe it's equivalent to 5,000 degrees Kelvin. And if I've got a big enough integration factor in my radiometer, like I just described, 1,000 makes bandwidth in front of the detector, 10 hertz or 1 hertz bandwidth after the detector, I can now detect 1 degree Kelvin change in the antenna temperature as that antenna sweeps across that star. I can measure 1 degree Kelvin difference, even though my receiver has a noise temperature of 10,000 degrees Kelvin. It's equivalent to standing inside your house, looking out the picture window at nighttime, and your front yard through the picture window is blocked, it's dark. And so you pick up this floodlight in your hand, and you aim it out the window. And yet you're lighting up the front yard. But you're also getting a huge reflection off the window. The reflection off your own window blinds your ability to see what's going on and on the front yard that you're lighting up with the flash, with the floodlight. Okay. If I can control the environment, in other words, somebody is going to put a let's say a little white card out there on the front lawn. He's going to put the white card on the front lawn on the odd minutes, and he's going to take it away on the even minutes. And you do a very careful measurement of total amount of reflected power you get from the front lawn plus the reflection of the window simultaneously. If I do a very careful measurement of the odd minutes versus the even minutes, and I know that one of them the white card is there and one of them the white card is not there, I'll see a very subtle difference in the total amount of power I receive, and I might be able to detect the light coming from the card, even though it's 1,000 times weaker than the light that's coming from the reflection from the window. If I got the right kind of instrumentation, and I flip back and forth between the two states, I can make that measurement, and I can say, okay, Mel, I know you're putting down that card on the odd minutes and taking it away on the even minutes, because the one answer on the odd minutes is bigger than the answer in the even minutes. When I keep repeating that experiment and adding up the energy I get during those minutes differentially, all the odd minute energy I put into the capacitor number one, all the even energy I detect in rectifier I put in capacitor number two, and I got a meter between those two capacitors, and I can tell if the meter is a 0 centimeter, and I can tell if it moves to the right or moves to the left, and I know right away whether the odd minutes or even minutes have the card out there. That is a simple, similar experiment to radiometry. I wonder if you see what I'm doing here. That's a radiometry experiment where I'm allowed to see, if I do it correctly, I can see things a hell of a lot dimmer than the noise of my own receiver. In this case, it's the reflection of the picture window. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. I know there's a whole science with it. It's quite fascinating. I know we touched upon very little bit of it. And one heck of a trip to see this thing. And I took away a lot of thinking about what the heck they would do. It was quite amazing. That's basically the bottom line. It was, at that time, the cutting edge of technology, and I can imagine what they come up with now. However, all that, have they found any evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence? I guess the answer is no. Oh, okay. Well, I don't know if they're even searching for that anymore. I think they may have given that up. They were spending hundreds of hours those days searching for the extraterrestrials. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, that W1HFA, yeah, Paul Horowitz, he was in charge of that whole field back in the 70s, around 75 to 80. He was doing that whole deal there. He was running that whole show with me, searching for, I think they used to call it, what, 21 centimeters neutral hydrogen line wavelength field. And, oh, I remember one thing. I remember how they did the translation of everything. Use of the fast Fourier transform, you know, FFT. That was quite fascinating, how to do the analysis of FFT at the time. So, all right. Anyhow, like I say, great to reminisce about this magnificent piece of equipment. All right, let's go on, I guess. It's over.
Welcome to the W2L repeater.
Okay, you said that we're not doing a SETI search anymore, search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Not true. It is not a major effort, but it is far from a discontinuing effort. Jill Totter, who's the president of the SETI Institute in California, cut her teeth as far as radio astronomy and SETI search is concerned by being a student of Dr. Tom Clark, W3IWI, with his old call letters. I think it's W3IO now. And I sat down with him for a couple of hours over this last 3 days. And we had a we locked horns on a couple of disagreements as to how the laws of physics are working. Jill Totter is still reasonably well-funded to continue her SETI search. And it is a multi-channel spectrum analyzer that's doing that search these days. And we started off doing it at the neutral hydrogen line, 21 centimeters. There's a hell of a lot of other lines across the so-called watering hole, as they call it. From roughly 1,000 to 10,000 megs is where the 1,000 to 10,000 megahertz is where the atmosphere has maximum transmissivity and therefore maximum transparency. And so a lot of searching is going on there. As I said, it's not a major effort. It's not the major effort. Major effort is really mapping space with higher and higher resolution with polarimetry. Polarimetry with Zeeman effect allows you to assess the local magnetic field. Another way we're doing SETI search is by exoplanet research. They've now got something like 230 recognized individual planets going around other stars other than the Sun. Something like 160 stars have planetary systems that have been detected so far. Total of 230 planets. Now, most of those planets detected so far are not in the Goldilocks zone. They're not in that great spot, not too close like Mercury and not too far away like Pluto. Mercury is too hot, Pluto is too cold. Earth is just right. And so, because of the detection techniques being used, we're only detecting the fast, hot planets, the ones that are close to the star and large in size like Jupiter, simply because of sensitivity to detecting equipment. So as the detecting equipment gets more and more sensitive, we get better and better hardware, we're going to detect more and more of the stars in the more and more stars that have planets in the Goldilocks zone. So in order for there to be the extraterrestrial light, we're really changing the methodology of the search. We used to just choose various stars saying that, hey, there's a star like the Sun. Let's aim in that direction and see if we see a signal. Well, now you want to find the star that's got planets that have the Goldilocks zone where they are capable of supporting carbon-based biological life as we know it. We think it's the most interesting kind of life. That's a speculation, but you've got to start somewhere. So you want to maximize your probability of success. I mean, if you're a single guy and you want to get married, you go to the place where the desirable ladies are and hope you find one. But when it comes to a SETI search, we're going to look at the stars that have the desirable planets that are in the Goldilocks zone. So there's all kinds of simultaneous work going on for finding the planets and then aiming at those and looking for the signals. So SETI is far from dead. However, if you go to the National Science Foundation today and ask for major funding because you've got the brand new Schneider technique for doing extraterrestrial search, the chances of them funding you are not so good, because they know that that's a very long-range project with very low probability of success, and National Science Foundation is getting their money from Congress or whatever, and they're limited in their funds, and they have to show results. They're a little bit afraid to put a lot of their money into a project that's not likely to show results real soon. So what's going on with most of the SETI searches that we've got right now is they are privately funded by people who are patrons of the art. You've got to have it's not the equivalent of, what do they call it now? I can't figure the slang that's used for the people who are willing to put up a whole lot of money. But you know what I mean. There are venture capitalists. You don't go to a venture capitalist to fund a SETI search. You go to a person who is not looking for profit. He's looking to push forward some particular technology that he is interested in. And he doesn't want return on his investment. There are a few of those people with deep pockets that have got the money and willing to fund them. And so Jill Carter has the benefit of some of those people. She really got started, the SETI Institute got started, because of Bonnie Oliver, the former chairman of the board, no longer, he's a silent key, Bonnie Oliver, who was chairman of the board of Hewlett Packard Corporation. He had the money to fund things like this. K2KEY, K2LIW.
That's right, Nat, this is KTTY, the aspirin over. Recently, Ball is no longer, I think, involved, because, like you said, the government is not going to, in any way, I think, continue sanctioning, you know, officially any more of the searching business. I think they also, they gave up on that, UFOs and all those things. They have spent a tremendous amount of money on all these different things that went really, I guess, as far as they're concerned, nowhere. All right, I think we should go on, Dick, over.
A philanthropist, somebody who gives a lot of money.
What was that word again, Howie?
We have to know, it's a philanthropist, somebody who gives a lot of money to charity, a philanthropist. I don't even think I'm pronouncing it right.
That's the right word, philanthropist. You're absolutely right. We need a philanthropist. By the way, Jill Carter, the head of the SETI Institute, is the lady that was being copied, you could say, by Jodie Foster in the movie, what the heck is the name of that movie with Jodie Foster? What's it called? All of a sudden I've forgotten the name of the movie. And Jodie Foster is a radio astronomer.
Contact.
That's the movie, Contact. Okay. Her story is really copied after Jill Carter. And, so you could say that She's the person that was being imitated in that movie. So, I think it's time you open up your mailbag, Mel. You got it, Mel.
Okay, roger. It's like you say, spend the whole night on this subject. All right, well, we got something left over from last. You had these queries, Dick, to come up with the, remember we talked about the antenna called the gap, and about the elevated feet, vertical, whole business, and you said to me I know where the article on it was. So if you would like to look, quite an interesting article, you know, something that's never not covered in the antenna manual. They cover a lot of things in the antenna manual, but nothing about this business about these elevated feet monopoles. This gap antenna design, which there are a number of antennas commercially being produced with this. So if you go to, I think, January 1995, USA, you see a number of pages that are quite interesting. They did quite a coverage on the theory and everything, and the technical correspondence from the technical correspondence by VE2CV. John, about the vertical monopole with elevated feet, full-length radiator system. go through a whole business about debunking some of the nonsense about what people thought they knew about it, and how he scientifically went ahead and did all the kinds of experiments with this thing. He also, there was also another extensive coverage called the grounded monopole with elevated feet, low takeoff angle vertical for 10 through 80 meters. And this was published in May, covered by the same thing, John, CE2CV, in May 1983 M Radio Magazine, 1983, May of issue. And also, extensive research, deep shot, formula, you name it. Unbelievable how we figured out the current distribution for elevated feet, monopoles, and things like that. I think you mentioned to me you were doing some work in that field, over.
Yeah, very close to what you're now addressing, although a little bit more basic. I was hitting both Dr. Tom Clark. I didn't get a chance to do it with Dr. Joe Taylor. I did it with, trying to figure the other guy's name now. Clark and, Tom, Dr. Tom Williams. They all have the say in step. And the process of saying in step, once you know the structure of the antenna, you can figure out, with modern-day computer programs, exactly how much current is flowing through each little section of the antenna. And what these programs do, the so-called finite element analysis programs, is they take each little subsection, each little finite element, so to speak. Once you know the current that flows there, you know what the local magnetic field is going to be like. You take all those little pieces and you add them up in some point far away in space. And you figure out how all those vectors add. And from that, you figure out the pattern. Once you get the pattern, you know the game. So, with a modern-day antenna, as long as it resonates and you can calculate the current distribution along the antenna, you can calculate the pattern. And in the old days that was pretty difficult. Nowadays with computer modeling can do a very good job, and you can do it on Yagi-like structures, which are reasonably complicated. I think Yagi modeling has gone as far as 32 elements on one single Yagi. There are Yagis you can buy from directive systems that go up to 102 elements. And I think that sent computer modeling up to at least 32 and maybe beyond. The one place where the computer modeling doesn't work so far is when the elements are super fat. And there's a bunch of reasons why they can't quite do it there. Very fat in wavelength, like 5 or 10% of a wavelength. For a complicated structure like a Yagi, all of a sudden the computer modeling program breaks down unless it's a supercomputer. And to my knowledge, no one has done it that way yet. So, the grounded monopole with, I think you said, elevated takeoff, May 1983 ham radio, and the elevated feed monopole, Jan 1995 QSD. I wonder if I got that right, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah, ham radio was May 83. And the other article, January 1995 of USA. You read it over and then you let me know if you can understand how this thing works, because after I read the piece on here, how does it work, I came away with not sure. I really do not understand the operation of this antenna completely. Something I'm missing in there, and I don't think the author has conveyed correctly what he thinks is the way this antenna works, over.
Well, the conclusion I came to in the last few days is that the most basic antenna is a dipole. Half of a dipole is a monopole or a ground plane. And if you understand what the word morphing means from a modern day computer-generated graphics point of view, you realize that almost every Wii antenna we use, if you don't count the lens portion of, say, for instance, the parabolic dish, or a quasi-optical lens, if you just look at the feed horn, or you look at the Yagi, you look at the ground plane, you look at the J-pole, you look at any of these antennas, They really are a dipole or a monopole. A monopole really is the upper half of a dipole, and the bottom half is the mirror image that's in your counterpoise. So almost every single antenna we use is a dipole or a morphed version of a dipole. Once you come to that conclusion, you realize that that's the bedrock. What Heinrich Hertz did when he invented a dipole way back in, I think it was 1868 or something like that. I got to research that one. When he did it, he found something that worked. I'm not sure he understood all the theory of it. But since that's the most basic antenna, and since a dipole antenna made out of wire is probably the most popular antenna all amateurs in the world use, once you come to that conclusion, you say, gee, I really want to know how a dipole works. So here I've got a group of what I thought are very smart people, and a few of them I asked the question. I said, assume that I've got a full half-wave dipole, and it's exactly 72 ohms resonant, 72 ohms resistance impedance, no reactance left over. I'm feeding it with 72 ohm twin lead, and I'm feeding it in a pure differential manner, no common mode current. And it's a steady state situation. I've been running the transmitter for some time, and it's 72 volts coming out of the transmitter. So 72 ohm twin lead going into a 72 ohm antenna with 72 volts means I've got exactly 1 ampere flowing, both on the transmission line and on the beginning of the dipole. So now we know the current, and assuming the transmission line is lossless, and the dipole is an ordinary dipole, reasonably low and long. The question I asked each of these guys was, I'm putting in a nice sine wave, and I'm, in my mind, going to stop the action at the positive peak of the sine wave, then I'm going to turn the time back on again. I'm going to watch that positive part of the waveform flow down the transmission line, go around the right angle corner right at the end of the transmission line, and it climbs onto the wire with 1 ampere of current of the dipole. And I said, okay, fellas, tell me what happens next, and do not skip any steps. A naive person would say, all right, I launched a signal on the dipole, it goes on the dipole and jumps into space and radiates. There's a whole lot of steps in between. I asked them, what happens next? And it turns out a lot of the guys had the raw information. They had the ingredients. They know sort of about what happened, but they didn't have it all put together in the way that I was asking for. And a number of them would say that there's a current distribution, there's a higher voltage at the far end, there's a lower voltage in the center, and I convinced them that that signal has to bounce back and forth 30 times before it's radiated, and that if the dipole was thoroughly shielded, the input impedance at the center would be 0 ohms. Thoroughly shielded dipole means the right side and the left side would be a quarter wave, open circuit, stub. And the stub is low and long, it's open circuit, quarter wave long, input impedance is short, 0 ohms. So the dipole would have 0 ohms of impedance if there was no radiation. If every bit of the signal radiated on the first pass of the wire, the impedance would be many thousands of ohms, because it's like a piece of microstrip. That's what the wire is, laying parallel to the ground, but it's 100 feet in the air. It's a microstrip with a few thousand ohms of impedance. So it would be a few thousand ohms that you would see if the signal just went down the wire and jumped into space. It doesn't do that. The fact that you see 72 ohms is telling you you're geometrically speaking midway between short circuit and open circuit, so to speak. So what really happens is the signal goes down to the end, hits an open circuit, reflects without phase inversion, and comes back. It takes a quarter wave in time to go down, quarter wave in time to come back. By the time it comes back, your positive portion of the waveform you're analyzing is now encountering the negative portion of the wave coming out of the transmitter, because it's a half wavelength delayed in time. So the positive voltage and the negative voltage almost cancel if there was no radiation, if there was no loss. There's roughly 3% loss on each bounce, rough number. That's what's giving you the 72 ohm, not complete cancellation. And that signal has to bounce 30 times, and if your wire is a little bit long, they don't all those bounces don't stay in step. They start lagging a little bit, and we call it inductive reactance. So I said, just think about the evidence you've got in your own experience that supports this. You've all swept the dipole, and if you've got the right instrumentation, you recognize the fact that the resistive component changes slowly, and the reactive component changes very fast. Whether or not all those bounces stay co-phase is what's important. A dipole has a finite frequency bandwidth, like a 5% or so, where it has 2-to-1 standing wave ratio because of reactance, because the bounces fall out of step with each other. They fall out of phase. A number of them said, it's about time somebody said that. It's an interesting way of looking at it. It's closer to reality. No book states that, and yet gives you a little bit more of an intuitive feel for what's really happening, why the so-called resonance of the radiating system takes place. So I had quite a bit of fun with that, and quite a bit of interchange took place on that. And so it sounds a little bit silly for microwave people to be discussing a dipole. That little probe that's inside your microwave oven is a monopole, half of a dipole. That probe that's inside your waveguide feed for your parabolic dish is a monopole. Almost all the antennas we use are a dipole, a monopole, pole, or a slightly morphed version of it. I'm slowly concluding almost every antenna we use is a dipole or a subset of a dipole. That was slightly amazing to me. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, point. First of all, when you get a chance, read over the thing with the vertical monopole system and tell me, just explain to me simply how the heck they're getting it to work on all these bands. What the heck are these rods? How do these rods achieve the process of being able to work from 10 through 80 meters? I'm not sure, really, how that really is achieving that by just so-called tuning rods that hang on the side there. Well, anyway, well, Dick, gee, a lot of people, I don't know, Bill, I guess there's so many of us around, have been using, you know, non-resonant antennas and feeding them, you know, with the open wire transmission line. So, actually, if you want to look at it, that the antennas are not resonant antennas, yet they do radiate quite well, over.
Okay. Even though you're feeding with an open wire line, even the thing you call antenna is not resonant, no. I believe you are resonating your radiating system. Your radiating system consists of the thing you call dipole, a thing you call antenna, the transmission line, the antenna tuner if you're using one, the pi tank network of the transmitter, and the tube of the transmitter itself, or the final transistor. That whole system, when you do the tuning and loading, you are forcing it into resonance. Only if you had an infinitely long wire, would the signal go down that wire once and never come back to you. You wouldn't need resonance. And every little bit of the wire would radiate a small amount of it, by the time you go a mile downrange, 98% of it would be radiated in space. So even though you think your antenna is non-resonant, now, by the time you finish looking at the length of your transmission line, the length of the wire, the antenna tuner, the pi network that you're tuning and loading, when you tune and load, you're forcing the total system into resonance. So are you sure that your non-resonant antenna isn't resonating? What do you think, Mel?
That's a good point, because we look at it this way, that a truly resonant antenna at one frequency, let's say a specific frequency, will be really truly resonant. And at that point, the current in the antenna is at a different phase, yeah, different phase compared to the applied voltage, basically, because, in other words, the feed point peak is either composed of capacitive or inductive reactants in series, I would assume, over.
But you don't get capacitive inductive reactants unless you have multiple reflections that fall out of step by leading in phase or lagging in phase. That's where the capacitance is coming from. Your piece of wire is so far above the ground that the capacitance between it and ground is 0.01 picofarad. Yet when you're feeding it in an RF manner, you're thinking you're seeing 30 ohms or whatever of capacitive reactance, and at your particular frequency, that may represent 300 picofarad. what you're calling capacitance is all of these multiple bounces falling out of phase, leading or lagging, and that's the phase angle of the current you're getting of the multiple bounces. So you're not measuring capacitance in a direct manner. Through your feed line and antenna tuner and PI tank network, you're forcing the total system to resonate. That's what's causing the reactive current, I put it in quotes, that you're seeing. We call it reactive. It acts like a capacitor. It is not a real capacitor. It is these bounces leading or lagging in phase. That's what I'm saying, Mel. I don't blame you for saying this is kind of a radical way of explaining it, and maybe it's a little hard to swallow the first time. And I've been challenged a lot this weekend by people who slowly came around saying, you might have something there. K2KEY, K2LIW.
I'm trying to think in your direction because what there's always the theory that has been accepted is that the feed point, the peak, is not pure resistance, I would assume, over.
The feed point looks like pure resistance if the antenna is a resonant or multiple of a resonant length. There, all the bounces fall in step, they're not leading or lagging, and therefore you think you see no resistance, no reactance, and you see only pure current in phase, and you call it resistance. But when you see reactance on the impedance going into an antenna, that means your bounces are leading or lagging, we call it reactance, we call it capacitor reactance or inductor reactance, and your feed line and its impedance inverting phenomena like what your Smith chart shows you is doing, the feed line with its length is inverting that into some point, that circle around the center of your Smith chart, which represents your impedance of your antenna, and where in that circle you are is a function of how long your feed line is in wavelength. That's what your transmitter sees. And when you readjust the tuning and loading of that PI network, you're forcing that whole system into resonance. You wouldn't be seeing that current if you weren't forcing it into resonance. If that signal went down the wire once and jumped into space, you would always see 10,000 ohms or something like that. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, I'm trying to picture this a little bit closely. This is K2KEY. I can see that an antenna of the feed point peak is not just the pure resistance. It has to have some, I guess, some feed point peak. It has to be composed of some capacitive or inductive reactance in series. The reactance, in other words, has to be in series with the resistance, correct, Oler?
Okay, there's two things you're saying that are close to right, but I'm going to differ with them a little bit now. First of all, you're saying the reactance has to be in series. There's a yes and a no to that. Whenever you get any impedance of any network that you can put into a black box, or any network you can put at the 40-foot level on your backyard and your street, any network can have a series equivalent or a parallel equivalent. Once you fix the frequency, and you say, gee, it acts like 1 millihenry in series with 72 ohms. That's the series equivalent circuit. I can also come up with a parallel equivalent circuit that if I put both of them in a black box, one in each black box, at that frequency you couldn't tell the difference. So there's always an equivalent. And if you want to think series, and I think in series just like you, most of the time, 98% of the time, I think in series. It's the simplest for me to analyze on my calculator. But when I'm starting to put shunt devices in there to match it, if I flip over to the parallel equivalent circuit, it's a little bit easier to do the math. So I flip back and forth sometimes. But that series network is a representation. If the antenna is exactly a length where all the bounces stay in phase, in that circumstance, and you and I can do it, we can carefully tune with clip leads or whatever, any antenna you got, so that the reactive component goes to zero at that frequency. You can always force an antenna to be a pure resistor at one frequency. And when you do that, you'll suddenly realize the antenna is an exact multiple of a half wavelength long, either a half wavelength or one wavelength or one and a half wavelength, some exact multiple so that all the bounces stay in step. So we don't have to have a reactance all the time. But you're absolutely right. 99% of the time, you had some amount of reactance. And maybe if you want to be persnickety enough and you're going to measure reactance down to a micro-ohm, yes, we always have reactance. But it doesn't have to dominate if the wire is the right length so that all the bounces stay in step. Most of the time, they're not all in step. We do see some reactance, and we can represent it either in series or parallel if we're smart enough. That's what I'm saying, Mel. Back to you.
Okay, got a question. This is K2KDY. We take this antenna, dipole, we're going to make it out of test material. I don't know. Super good. Make it out of silver wire, whatever. And we're going to physically get this dipole into the best up there in, I don't know, suspended with skybook, whatever. Float it around up there somewhere. We would get, let's say, 73 ohms. Will we have a plus or a minus J something pick over?
Okay, plus or minus J is the reactive component if it's there. I usually represent an impedance as open parentheses, number, like 72, comma, J, number, which represents the reactance, closed parentheses. So a perfect antenna would be open parentheses, 72, comma, J, 0, closed parentheses. It doesn't have to be a J. It can be 0. The J can be a little bit negative. You and I call it a capacitor. The J can be a little bit positive. You and I call it an inductor. But it doesn't have to be a J if I'm smart enough in choosing the right length of the antenna, which is one approach. Force the antenna into resonance. That's the naive, direct approach. But you and I are capable of making open wire feed line that's low enough in loss. We're capable of making an antenna tuner that's low enough in loss or high enough in efficiency. We're capable of building pi tank circuits that are high enough efficiency. Under those circumstances, I don't have to waste the time mechanically forcing resonance of the antenna. I can electronically force resonance by twisting those knobs. And as long as the total system resonates, it'll radiate like a banshee. If the total system doesn't resonate, which usually means there's a high reactance, now I can't pour power into it. My transmitter is capable of making 100 watts, but I can only get half a watt into it. I ain't going to be very loud on the air. So for reasonable efficiency on what the transmitter is capable of doing, and to try to get all that power into the antenna and eventually into the air, I'm going to resonate the system. But the J doesn't have to always be there. And by the way, if I want to remeasure the impedance of the total network back at the tube, that's where the rubber meets the road. He's the guy that's generating the steam. If I want to make the measurement at the tube, I'm going to say, for every reasonable antenna you've ever used, when you properly tune your knob, the tube sees a pure resistive load because you've resonated the system. Maybe that should be our point of resonance, a point of reference, right at the tube, looking into all that jazz downrange, the pi network, the antenna tuner, the feed line, and the antenna. From that point of view, we always get rid of reactance when we have an efficient radiator. Try that one on for size. K2RIW.
That's where the SO239 is, Dick, at the tube. Not at the back of the radio.
That's one approach. Go ahead, Mel.
And it says K2KEY. All right. Now, theoretically, in other words, we can make a dipole, and it may be that the two wires are not precise. Maybe one's a little, you know, stretched a little bit, the this side, or copper or something in there, whatever. So, in other words, if we now are no longer, a dipole actually is when you're supposedly thinking of two poles. Dipole, I believe, comes from Greek word two poles. Now, what happens if, so as soon as one gets a little bit off, then we have now a off-center bed dipole, an OCF. So now, once we go slightly off-center feeding, Do we now automatically going to have a J factor of plus or minus 6 over?
It's both a yes and a no, though, in my mind, Mel. When I have a thoroughly symmetric dipole and a thoroughly balanced feed line, like twin lead, open wire line or whatever, I use the example of 72 ohm zip cord, 72 ohm twin lead. There, everything is purely balanced as far as nothing but differential energy is flowing down that transmission line, and there's no common mode energy. In other words, I could slice the wire open somewhere, the transmission line somewhere, and at that microsecond, I make a measurement. The positive wire is plus 37 volts, and the negative wire, the other wire is minus 37 volts. Thoroughly balanced, purely differential. If I feed the dipole in the center, and I go to a good balancing device down at the transmitter, I can force that. As I move the transmission line off center on the dipole, a couple of funny things happen. The dipole really is, I could say, a ground plane antenna which has a perfect counterpoise. I'm launching positive current into the right-hand side of the dipole by the third law of Newton. Yeah, I think it's Newton's third law. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. You can't just push current into the right-hand side of a dipole. You have to subtract current out of the left-hand side of something. In the case of a ground plane antenna, the ground plane is your counterpoise. In the case of a dipole antenna, the other half of the dipole is the ideal counterpoise. So, when I'm launching 1 ampere to the right, I have to be sucking 1 ampere out of the left. That's the balanced, center-fed dipole. Move off center, life gets more complicated. Because there is still a balance of the dipole at the dipole center, but I'm not feeding it there. I'm feeding it off to one side. By definition, my twin lead now has common mode. I slice open the twin lead, and I'm not going to get the same voltage on the right side as the left side. There's going to be a difference in magnitude. That means that I have a certain amount of differential power going down the feed line, and I have a certain amount of common mode power flowing back on the feed line, twin line. When you do that, and there's certain advantages of doing it, there are certain antennas. Windham is a classic example of an off-center fed dipole. Now you're using the transmission line also as a radiator. The transmission line, if you use it thoroughly differentially, it is almost a perfectly shielded circuit, even though it doesn't look it, and to the nearest 0.01%, it does not radiate. Feed your dipole off-center. You've now got common mode current flowing down both of those wires. By definition, those wires are doing some amount of radiating. And as long as those wires of the transmission line is the right length, that radiation, although it's somewhat different in polarization, is also radiating, and it may make a very nice dipole which radiates very nicely on 2 bands, 3 bands, or whatever. Carefully choose the off-center fed condition. The transmission line becomes part of the antenna. Slightly more complicated pattern, but the average guy doesn't care about the pattern of a Windham. He just cares about the Vizwire. And does the guy in England hear him that he's trying to talk to? And in cases where you're radiating both from your feed line and from the dipole, for all we know, we're launching elliptical polarization. After that gets off, bounced off of the ionosphere, I use the word bounce in quotes. After we get through the ionosphere by absorption and re-radiation, and does its thing by reflecting, in quotes, off the ground and back off the ionosphere, and eventually gets to London, and you talk to your buddy in London, he doesn't really give a darn whether your dipole did the radiating or your feed line did the radiating. If he hears the signal, he's happy and you're happy. So when you force the feed line to do the radiating, can you now see an input Vizwire on the transmission line? Well, now you've got two different definitions of Vizwire. I've got a differential impedance. I can worry about it, Vizwire. I've got a common mode impedance. I can worry about it, Vizwire. After it's been through your balancing structure, that may be part of your antenna tuner, and it gets to your Pi network, it gets back to the tube itself. As well, Howie said, that's where the SO239 is. Make believe it's right at the tube. That's where the rubber meets the road. That's where the power is being generated.